ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
How reliable is your memory of a crime scene? And can those memories be manipulated?
Connected to wrongful convictions?
How a memory works can be damaging for a justice system and for the integrity of a justice system.
This is Sana Qadar from All in the Mind. If you are a fan of true crime, you should check out our new series, Forensic. It's about the quirks and curiosities of our weird human brains. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols, freshly returned from Wurundjeri country in the southwest of WA, where I was at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival with the current Booker winner, David Saloy. David won the Booker last year for his novel Flesh. It's about Istvan, a young man living between Hungary and England. And this is a guy who doesn't talk much. Instead, he seems to be driven by the body. For Istvan, it's his lust, his anger, and yes, his love, that take his story to all sorts of unexpected places, including, by the end of the first chapter, to jail for a violent crime. I spoke with David Saloy in front of a live audience of book lovers.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So, David, in 2016, you almost won the Booker. You were shortlisted for All That Man Is. Apparently, you were really, really close to winning, is the gossip. So I want to start by knowing what it's like to not win the Booker.
Yeah, it's... It's not as fun as winning. In 2016, on the actual evening of the prize giving ceremony, I didn't enjoy that evening at all. I was very, very tense, very, you know, stressed out. And the whole thing was, it felt incredibly long. It felt like it lasted for days, this sort of dinner and speeches and, you know, and they obviously the actual announcement they put at the very end. So that was really not a very pleasant experience. And also, I guess I had a sense at that time that there was a huge amount at stake, that this, I sort of felt that this was probably my one chance, if you like. And that, of course, made the tension all the worse and more unbearable. So, and then I didn't win. And you know, of course, there's an initial kind of disappointment. But I quickly, you know, I mean, you come back from that, whatever. It's, you know, it's all good anyway. You're at least shortlisted. So it wasn't like I plunged into some awful long depression. I mean, within a few days, I was fine. And in fact, I saw the positive side of it, which is that coming out of that experience, I still felt very sort of, I felt that in terms of writing my next book, it might have been better not to have won, basically, because it sort of, in a way, it sort of kept me very sort of sharp. Whereas by winning, and I'm going to discover this, whether this is really true, I guess, quite soon, by winning, you know, you might get a bit complacent, a bit lazy, a bit sort of, you know, what do I have left to, I can, whatever, you know, just a bit flabby. So, and then coming into last year's ceremony, I was very determined not to have just exactly the same experience of the evening as I'd had.
So how do you do that? Do you go, I'm having a positive mindset, I'm going to have fun tonight?
No, in a way, you have to have a negative mindset. You have to kind of think, I'm not going to win. Yeah. And that's okay. You know, I'll cope. I'll survive. It'll be fine. And of course, one important thing is part of the sort of pressure in the first case in 2016 was, as I said, this sense that this is my one shot. By definition, having the fact that I was back meant that, you know, it wasn't my one shot. So that probably helped a bit. And then I really did quite thoroughly convince myself that I wasn't going to win. And it, you know, but partly in order to sort of enjoy the evening for itself, but partly because I guess in some ways Flesh isn't a typical Booker winner. So that sort of made it seem less likely as well. And then I met the judges and the shortlisted authors kind of avoid each other.
Yeah.
Because the first hour or two of the evening, everyone's just milling around. It's sort of like a sort of cocktail party setup. But in that sort of milling crowd, I think the judges and the shortlisted authors try and give each other a wide berth so that whatever, just it's a bit awkward. But I did find myself face to face with one of the judges.
Was it Sarah Jessica Parker?
No, it was Kylie Reid. And we just kind of walked, you know, we were just suddenly facing each other and it was too late to sort of swerve away or anything. And in fact, I think somebody introduced us, so then it really was impossible to ignore each other. And she, after sort of saying hi, she said, "We really loved your book," in this kind of sad voice that massively implied a but. And in fact, I mean, if her aim was to throw me off the scent, it was a work of genius because it completely did. And in fact, I went straight to my wife and I found her and said, "Now I'm sure I'm not going to win." And I also had a cold. I'd taken flu medication. I was a bit woozy. And altogether, actually, I had quite a good evening, even before I won.
And then Roddy Doyle.
And then Roddy Doyle told me that I'd won. And it was kind of crazy, yeah.
Yeah, and when you got up and spoke, you spoke about the risk of flesh. How risky did it feel to write this novel?
I think the biggest risk I had in mind was the book doesn't really give the reader much direct guidance about how to respond to the character. So I really wasn't sure when the book was published how readers would respond to the character, because I think the book only works if the reader feels some kind of sympathy for the character. That did feel like a slight risk. And yeah, that was probably the main thing I had in mind.
What's the pleasure in writing a book that is risky?
I think risk is really important in writing. I mean, in any sort of creative endeavor, actually. I think that risk and the thing being interesting are closely related. So I think risk is necessary. I think you have to, if you're not taking any risks when writing a book or anything like that, then that's kind of worrying. I mean, there should be some sense of risk somewhere. Because risk tends to mean that you're in a zone where things become interesting.
Mm-hmm. I want to know a little bit more about you, David Saloy. You were born in Canada, grew up in the UK, now you live in Vienna, but your heritage is Hungarian. Can you tell me about that part of your family?
The Hungarian part?
Yeah.
Sure. My dad's Hungarian. He grew up in Hungary, left as an adult. He then emigrated to Canada via Vienna. In fact, he lived himself in Vienna for a year in the late 60s. And then obviously he met my mother, who's Canadian, and I was born there. But yeah, he was the only member of his family to leave Hungary. He has a brother and three sisters, and I have numerous cousins. And they all, to this day, with one or two exceptions from my generation who have left, still live in Hungary. So yeah, it was as a kid, I went back to Hungary every year, more or less, from about 1980. So I have childhood memories of kind of communist Hungary, which was obviously a very different world from London, where I was growing up. And it was quite extraordinary, I guess, to go and see that world on a regular basis. And I lived there for a few months in the early 90s, but it was in about 2010 that I moved there myself and lived there for about a decade.
How did you fit in?
Well, I'm a bit of an oddity there, you know. I have a Hungarian name. I don't speak Hungarian very well. This is the key thing.
Mm-hmm.
If my dad had taught me Hungarian as a child, as some of his Hungarian friends in London, you know, spoke to their kids in Hungarian from the beginning and so on. If I spoke Hungarian to that level, then I kind of almost would be able to sort of blend in Hungary. I'd almost be able to kind of be a Hungarian in Hungary. But because I don't, that's not possible. So even though I have the family connection, I have a Hungarian name, I have a lot of experience of the country, I'm always a bit of an outsider there.
But you probably would have been an outsider in the UK too, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a more subtle thing, I guess, because having grown up there, I've, you know, I feel very at home there. As you can hear, I sound very much like someone who grew up there. But yes, because neither of my parents is British. Mm. And obviously the name is an immediate kind of marker of not being British in that sense. But that's much more subtle, I'd say. In Hungary, I really am just a foreigner.
This idea of not fitting into a place, particularly in Hungary, can you talk about how that has found its way into this novel, Flesh?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the things I started with, actually, when thinking about the novel. I wanted to write a book that had a Hungarian aspect and an English aspect. I wanted to write a book that actually, in some way, sort of explored the feelings I had at that time of being sort of stretched or marooned between these two countries. Now, obviously, István's story and everything in the book really is got nothing to do with my life in a sort of literal sense. But those feelings of fitting in 100% in neither place. And of course, by the time I wrote the book, I'd been living away from London for, 8 or 10 years. So that had changed my relationship with London quite significantly, as it will. I mean, if you don't live in a place, you lose that intimate day-to-day connection with it. And that was important. That was an important kind of emotional ingredient in that situation as well. So it was quite conscious that I set out to write a book that had a character who was sort of divided between these two places and had a slightly ambiguous relationship with both of them.
And I'm guessing that the timing of this novel is quite deliberate as well, because our central character, István, grows up in Hungary. He spends his adult years in London, but he comes to London around the time that Hungary would have joined the EU.
Yes.
And he leaves kind of at the time when England was leaving the EU.
He leaves later. I mean, it's absolutely the case that he moves to England at the time that Hungary joins the EU. And that's, I mean, the book in a way is a kind of, it covers a lot of recent European history from the kind of fall of the Berlin Wall era when it starts. The Iraq War is involved. Hungary joining the EU and the other countries of the region joining the EU is involved. COVID gets a brief nod. So it covers these decades of European history. And it's not just sort of that it covers them because it wants to cover them. It's significant in terms of the sort of action and themes of the book as well, because one idea that I guess in the book is the way that these big things like Hungary joining the EU affect people's lives, in very real and immediate, thoroughgoing ways. And obviously all our lives are subject to stuff like that, in one way or another. So István, the character in the book, he has the opportunity to move to London because Hungary joins the EU. He wouldn't have had that opportunity otherwise, really. And that changes his whole life. And, so that it's this interaction between these sort of big political, historical events and the lives of individuals are not at all abstract. They're totally concrete. And so he moves to England at that point, and he becomes very settled there. And obviously his life would not have been the same had he not done that.
And the book opens in the early 1990s, and this was when Hungary was coming out of this Soviet era. So tell me about this very specific moment in time for Hungary. What life would have been like at this moment?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was probably the biggest moment of all in recent history of Hungary and as I say, all the other countries that had a similar sort of historical experience. I remember visiting Hungary at that era, and it's hard for us to kind of imagine such a big shift, because it's like everything that was true yesterday isn't true today, the change was kind of monumental, totally pervasive. And for István's generation, people who were, teenagers at that time, that was fine, and sort of there was something of kind of adolescence about the whole thing. But for people who were kind of middle-aged at that time, it was really tough, because you're kind of halfway through your life. And then suddenly it's like everything that was true for the first half of your life is now not true. Obviously, it was kind of good as well. There was freedom, democracy and so on. But on a lower level, it was a very culturally and psychologically, it was very difficult for that generation. But for Istvan's generation, for the people who were just coming of age at that moment, of course, it was straightforwardly good. They didn't have to learn Russian at school anymore. The book starts, obviously, Istvan's 15, and the sort of historical events of Hungary sort of emerging into its new existence kind of parallel his own adolescence in a way.
This is a book, I mean, the title is Flesh. It's no surprise that this is a book very much about the body, David Saloy. When did you know that Flesh was going to be the title?
Well, Flesh was the working title. I mean, it was literally the name of the file on my laptop for most of the time when I was writing the book. But I assumed that it would get a different title eventually because Flesh seems a bit vulgar, frankly, you know, a bit sort of tawdry, a bit embarrassing. I'm used to it now, but when the book was first published, I was quite embarrassed to tell people what it was called. So, and my publisher was very much of the same opinion. So when the book was finished and was being edited, we sort of started to think, now we're going to find the real title, the good, elegant, literary title, which is going to really elevate this whole thing. But we couldn't. So we decided to stick with Flesh. And someone pointed out, I think it was my agent pointed out, that the kind of feelings of slight unease and discomfort that the title was giving us was good. That was all good. That all reflected something real in the book and therefore was good. And that the title, that there was a reason why I had latched onto this word without really thinking about it as the working title of the book. So we went with it. I'm very glad we did. But I mean, Flesh also, as well as having, it sounds a bit like a sort of horror or porn, or, you know, it has all these kind of vulgar connotations. But it also obviously is a word that appears in the Bible in very many kind of significant moments. And so it also has this sort of parallel existence as quite a literary, you know, word with the sort of long heritage in the English language. And so, yeah, the fact that it has those two aspects also seem to reflect something of the book.
And I think it is important to have a title like Flesh on a book where when we get to the first page, we're going to have two teenage boys comparing how often they masturbate.
Yeah, it's a warning. It's its own trigger warning.
Yeah, exactly. But I am interested to know, you know, particularly the start where we have this teenage boy, Istvan, what did you want to explore about what it's like to be this kid going through these huge hormonal changes and maybe not even being able to keep up with what his body is kind of asking him to do?
Yeah. I mean, when I was writing that bit of the book, I wasn't sure whether it would be the first chapter of a book. In fact, I think, it's hard to remember exactly, but I think I have more had in mind that this might be a single standalone sort of short story. And, you know, I think it would work perfectly well as that. But having worked on it a bit, sort of edited it, gone through it, I thought this would be a great first chapter for a novel. It would really, you know, if this was the first chapter of a novel, I thought most readers would go on to chapter two and see what happened. So, yeah, that was when I guess I started to think of it in those terms and to basically plot out the rest of the novel and think about Istvan as a character. I mean, I knew from very early that I wanted it to be a novel covering many decades, sort of a big chunk of a person's life. I didn't want it to be a novel that was quite contained in time. You know, you could have written a novel that just explored that situation, I guess, and just took place over 1 year or something. But I knew from the beginning I didn't want to do that. So I then plotted out the rest. But Istvan's character was created in the context of that first chapter. And obviously, as you say, it's very physical, very hormonal, very, it's the sort of intense, confused, detached, and yet completely engrossed physically in the situation experience of someone of that age.
Yeah. There's a line later in the book where Istvan, you know, reflects on being so driven by his body, you know, you seem more powerless than ever to deny it what it wants. And it does often seem it is the physicality that is the first driver for this character beyond teenagerdom, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, the book is generally, I mean, one of the things the book's about, I think I would say, is the physicality of experience. You know, I mean, we're all physical bodies before anything else, in a way. You know, that's the bedrock of our existence, of our experience, and everything else kind of follows from that. The book isn't only about physical experience. It's a very emotional book, I think. And, you know, there are sort of intellectual ideas in there as well. But it starts with physicality. And as you say, physicality is always emphasized. Most of the main, perhaps all, but certainly most of the main plot elements in the book are to do with physical experiences of one kind or another. So yes, it's a book that definitely emphasizes that physicality of life more than perhaps most novels do.
Let's get to one physical experience. I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind reading a bit for us, David Saloy. So I'm sure a lot of people here have read Flesh, and particularly the first chapter where our young Istvan does the shopping for a neighbour across the road, and something interesting happens after one of these shopping trips that David's going to read a short excerpt from.
Sure, yeah. Afterwards, they walk back to the building where they live and up the stairs. There's no lift in the building and their flats are on the fourth floor. "You're very strong," she says to him as he puts the heavy stuff down on her kitchen table. He doesn't know what to say to that. He just nods, and she asks him if he wants some shomloy galushka. "Yeah, okay," he says. "Sit down then," she says. He sits at the table. The shomloy galushka is in the fridge, and she serves a large helping into a glass bowl and puts it in front of him with a spoon. "Thanks," he says. While he eats it, she puts the shopping away. He's becoming aware that she feels a sort of affection for him or something. It embarrasses him, and he also quite likes it in a way, even though he doesn't feel any affection for her. He doesn't feel anything for her. She's just this old woman, maybe even older than his mother. It's like she hardly exists. "How is it?" she asks, putting things away. "It's nice," he says. He eats it quickly, partly because it's delicious, and partly because he wants to be out of there as soon as possible. When he has finished it, he stands up, making the chair scrape loudly on the floor. "Okay, then," he says. "Can I kiss you?" she says. She's standing in front of him. The question is so surprising that he doesn't know what to say. He doesn't even know what she means, really. When he doesn't say anything, she kisses him on the lips. It's nothing. Her lips just lightly touch his for a moment. "I'm sorry," she says immediately afterwards. He just stands there. "I think you should go now," she says. Still without saying anything, he leaves and walks across the landing and lets himself into his mother's flat.
That's David Saloy reading from his novel Flesh, and this is The Book Show coming to you from the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival on ABC Radio National. This moment with this neighbour, David Saloy, it develops from there. Mm. And tell me what's going on between Istvan and this woman, because we all know originally he feels repulsed by her because she is 42, the same age as me. He thinks she's disgusting. But he's repulsed and he's attracted.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, he's confused. He wouldn't have thought of her in those terms at all. Obviously, it's her, she's the one who initiates anything. He's initially, as you in that passage I just read, his initial response is just kind of numb shock. She kind of keeps pushing it a bit, and eventually they're having a sexual relationship, which the book withholds judgment. This was another risk. This is another element of the sort of riskiness of the book. The book also withholds kind of moral judgments throughout the book, I think. And the first chapter really sort of exemplifies this, because obviously it's an ethically very problematic situation. A lot of people would characterize it as a form of abuse, certainly some kind of grooming. And it is, you know, that is one aspect of it for sure. The book doesn't make that judgment itself, but I think that that's fairly clear. But of course, it's also a very complicated situation, both emotionally and physically. I mean, what interested me about the situation when I was writing about it more than anything else was the way it goes through a series of quite extreme emotional transformations. So Istvan initially is sort of repulsed, or he's initially just shocked. And then he's never just purely repulsed, I wouldn't say. He's initially just shocked. And then there's a sort of mixture of desire and shame and a kind of feeling that he should not want this, but he nevertheless does. And that is results in a lot of shame and confusion. But eventually he kind of moves past those feelings too, and is just kind of just quite fully engaged in the situation. And of course he misunderstands the situation totally in the end, and he becomes much more emotionally involved than she is or ever would be or ever intended to be. And that, of course, ends up having sort of tragic and violent consequences. So it's really this very complicated situation that evolves quite dramatically in quite a short period of time. Mm. And it was that aspect of it that interested me. And then obviously the whole thing is very physically grounded from her point of view. He's the one who misunderstands that's her attitude. So yes, it was an interestingly complicated situation, I thought, as well as being, you know, it is quite shocking because of these sort of ethical issues, which are very, very much there.
I'm interested in what this means for Istvan for the rest of his life. You know, this is his formative sexual experience. And I noticed reading Flesh going forward, it's a theme that repeats, this relationship between sex and repulsion or sex and shame. Can you talk a bit about what this means for the way Istvan relates to women and relationships further into his life?
Yeah, I'm not sure that this kind of the shame thing, I'm not sure. I mean, it definitely sets a pattern, and the sort of most important relationship he has with the sort of romantic or sexual relationship he has in the book with the woman he eventually marries does start with a similar, the sort of power dynamic is similar in a very obvious way, even though the sort of basis of the power is completely different. In that case, it's to do with money and social status.
And she's his employer.
And she's his employer. So it's that money, social status, power thing is very concrete in that sense. So yes, that is a very important formative experience for Istvan, what happens in the first chapter. But really, there's that aspect of it, but then somebody gets killed. And that's just as important in terms both of his emotional life going forward, I would say, and also just narratively, because there are very practical, concrete consequences to that death which shape his life. You know, his life would have been totally different if that hadn't happened.
Yeah, by the end of the first chapter of Flesh, our protagonist Istvan is off to jail.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating because we're talking about a character being driven by physicality, and certainly by the end of the first chapter, being driven by physicality has not worked out well.
No.
For Istvan. And he spends time in a young offenders institution. He joins the army. He serves in Iraq. He's quite institutionalized in various ways. Like what does this time, and we don't see any of this in the book, but what do you think this time in all these various institutions, taking orders, being told what to do by other people, means for Istvan when we meet him as a man?
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, we don't really see his time in jail at all. I mean, the book consists of 10 chapters, which each give us just a glimpse of Istvan, really. Each chapter covers only a few weeks or months, and then the gaps between the chapters are often many years long. So we get these sort of brief glimpses of the character as he goes through life. And his time in jail, or the sort of young offenders institution, falls in a gap between two chapters. It's referred to quite briefly, but we don't see it. And his time in the army, we don't see most of it either. We see a bit more of it. We see him kind of returning from Iraq, leaving the army. And that whole chapter is very much concerned with, very explicitly, with the kind of repercussions, emotional, psychological repercussions of his time in the army. But yeah, by that age, and I guess he's about 30 at that point when he leaves the army. Yes, absolutely. He's been in institutions since he was in his late teens. So undoubtedly that shaped him too. But I guess I didn't really want the book to be a sort of psychological analysis of Istvan. That would have been a slightly different book that had sort of gone down the road of providing or attempting to be a sort of psychologically nuanced picture of Istvan. I mean, I think, you know, Istvan is a character with a psychology. Mm-hmm. It's just that the purpose of the book isn't to analyze that psychology.
I am nervous, David Saloy, to say the word masculinity to you, because I feel like people just want to talk to you about masculinity. And I know you didn't write Flesh to be a novel about masculinity.
Yeah.
In fact, you went back and took the word out almost completely, right?
I did. I mean, there were several, the word masculinity itself appeared a few times in the book, but I removed all but one instances of it exactly to try and dissuade people from asking me about masculinity.
And yet here we are.
I mean, I appreciate that all books need a hook, need a sort of simple one word explanation of what they're about. And masculinity was obviously the one that was picked for this. And I can see why, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it's not about masculinity. I'm not saying that's ridiculous. Obviously, it is about masculinity in some way. But it, for me, when I was writing it, that wasn't the main thing. And certainly, very certainly, I wasn't writing it as a contribution to some kind of contemporary debate about masculinity. Although I did kind of know that it might be taken like that in some quarters. So, and that's partly why I removed these, the instances of the word masculinity. The one that I left in is kind of direct speech or reported speech. It's another character with whom Istvan is in conflict, basically insulting Istvan by describing him as a kind of exemplar of a primitive kind of masculinity. And I left that one in, I think, because I found it was kind of interesting how difficult it was for me to say whether or not that was true. You know, I mean, Istvan, you could quite easily kind of take things from the book which say, yes, Istvan is a kind of, you know, exemplar of a primitive kind of masculinity. You know, his life is very physical. He works as a soldier, as a bodyguard, you know, these kind of ridiculously traditionally masculine occupations to do with physical violence and sort of physical imposingness. And, you know, there are various instances of violence in the book, uncontrolled violence, moments that would no doubt be characterized as toxic. So there is all of that, but there's a lot of other stuff too, which complicates it too much, really, to be able to say, yes, Istvan is this. So it was precisely that my inability to say whether or not that was true, either yes or no, neither answer seems entirely adequate. That's why I left it in, because I thought it drew attention to the complexity of Istvan.
But this is the joy of the novel, right? Mm. This is not an essay on masculinity.
Well, exactly.
This is a story, and we can read it and go, what kind of man is Istvan?
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, the two things I knew about Flesh before I read it, you know, according to the headlines that we saw about Flesh, were it's about masculinity and Istvan doesn't talk a lot. That's what we get told. Istvan just says, okay, yeah, okay. And it is true that Istvan is not having a lot of deep and meaningfuls that we get to see on the page. But what I think is the magic of Flesh is by the end of the book, I feel like I really understand this man who has not said much to me for 300 pages. Mm. How do you pull that off?
I'm not really sure. But that was definitely my aim. My aim was definitely that by the end of the book, the reader should feel sympathy for the character, but also, as you say, feel that they have some kind of understanding of this character, even though that it hasn't been kind of spelled out, you know, and they haven't been given the usual material that in a novel leads you to say that you understand the character. I mean, Istvan, it is obviously an exaggeration to say that Istvan only ever says okay and that we never get access to his thoughts and stuff. And we do quite often get access to his thoughts and his feelings. And yes, it was all very instinctive how it worked. And I mean, I think we often experience Istvan through other characters. And I think that helps us to feel sort of sympathy, empathy for him. I think it's significant that we see him both as somebody's child and somebody's parent. And the fact that we see Istvan in the context of those experiences that we all share means it's very hard for us not to feel some kind of sympathy for him.
Istvan ends up in the UK, where I think against all of our expectations, he finds himself for a while living this life of unimaginable wealth. Did you always know that this is where Istvan's life was heading?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I wanted him to go to England and prosper to some extent. And I suppose at some one point, I just thought I might as well have him prosper to a sort of absurd extent. You know, why hold back? Why not just sort of put him with the billionaire class? It's just more fun and more interesting.
You get to talk about pool tiles.
I can kind of make stuff up about private jets. It was fun writing that. And just creates this enormous range of experience, you know, between him, his life, the contrast between his life growing up. I mean, he's never exactly destitute. It's not like he's really impoverished in Hungary, but it's a very pretty rough and unmoneyed existence in a sort of council estate in Hungary. And so the contrast between that and, you know, these super wealthy people living in enormous houses in Chelsea in London and having sort of palatial country houses, it's just kind of satisfying to have that sort of amplitude in the book.
It was nice for him to have a driver, you know,
yes,
for a while.
Yes, well, exactly.
Not just be the driver. But, of course, again, because this is Istvan, his pathway to this wealth is, again, through the body. It's through an affair with a married woman that he's working for. My question for you, David Saloy, you know, when he reaches these peaks of wealth, is he any less deserving of his place in this world of the hoi polloi than anybody else who's there?
No, not at all. I mean, in a way, the idea, it's more like that. There's a kind of crazy lottery element to this.
I'm sure there are certainly people in the circles that Istvan is moving in that think that he does not deserve to be where he is.
Yeah, I mean, he encounters kind of soft. I mean, it's all very subtle and soft. I mean, it would be, and I think that's how it would be in reality. You know, it's not like there are people sort of, you know, Istvan doesn't belong in this room, leave immediately. But there's a kind of soft prejudice which he encounters.
I loved hearing you read from Flesh earlier, David. And one of the things I really admire about this novel is the simplicity of the writing, these very short sentences, these very direct explanations. Mm. How did you land on that style?
I mean, I think, as I said, I wrote the first chapter of the book as the first thing I wrote, and I wasn't sure whether it was going to be a standalone thing or the first chapter of a book at first. And so the style very much was created for that story. And I guess it was created to try and convey the world of the adolescent Istvan, to try and create this sense of detachment on one hand, but sort of numbness, confusion. Yeah, it was, part of it is definitely sort of about characterization, about sort of creating the world of the character. And part of it, the detachment of the style, the sort of pared back simplicity of it, was to do with, I felt that would create a stronger dramatic, imaginative and emotional impact than writing it in any other way. By sort of writing this story that's really quite shocking in many ways, in this very restrained style, that would be the best way of maximizing, in fact, the impact of it. And that applies in the end to the whole novel, I would say,
David Saloy, you were talking to me earlier about the concern that winning the Booker Prize might make you complacent.
Mm.
I'm guessing that you haven't had a lot of time to write, because winning the Booker is a full-time job.
It is.
But what has it meant for you as a writer? Have you found pockets of time to write?
I deliberately sort of carved out January and February and had virtually nothing like this in January and February. And I did manage to, I'm actually halfway through a book. I mean, Flesh was sort of finished 2.5 or 3 years ago. So I've started a new book in the meantime. And I did manage to sort of look over what I had in January and February and sort of do some kind of writing. But since then, no, I haven't done anything.
And is there a part of you that goes in and goes, well, I'm a Booker winner now. This is pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, I try to, you know, I don't want that to become who I am, like all of me. But I mean, I'd be dishonest if I said there was no, nothing like that. You know?
Well, good on you. Thank you for being honest. I was tempted to be cheesy and say it was nice to meet you in the flesh today, but that sounds
Well, you got it in there anyway.
David Saloy, it's been such a pleasure. Your book is Flesh. It is a fantastic novel, and it's been such a treat to have you here in Margaret River. Can you please all thank David Saloy?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks.
That was David Saloy with me, Claire Nichols, at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. And since we recorded that chat, I have also been to the Sydney Writers Festival. It's been a big week. I will have a conversation with the Life of Pi author Jan Martel to share with you. But before that, there's an episode next week that you will not want to miss. Anne Patchett will join me. It is always so fantastic to hear from her. Her new book is wonderful. So make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.